You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about the Obama administration's guidelines to public schools on transgender bathroom use issued today.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Speaker of the House and Janesville Republican Paul Ryan was in the news a lot this week as he found himself at odds with Donald Trump, Sarah Palin, and a challenger back home.
More news came out of Lincoln Hills this week, bringing up questions of inmate care at the juvenile detention facility, and two state lawmakers are planning on holding a wolf summit in northern Wisconsin.
Robert Menser joins us now to give us the latest on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network based in Wausau. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, Paul Ryan met with Donald Trump yesterday. This was an eagerly anticipated meeting, people wanting to know what was going to come of it. Well, what came of it?
Yeah, sort of the big news of the political world this week, the Paul Ryan Donald Trump summit. What came of it? Basically, they seemed to like each other. They both came out saying that it was a good, productive meeting. They feel they're on the path to reconciliation, but no immediate conversion for Ryan's part. He still said he was not ready to support Trump, but I think they're heading in the direction. Basically, what is happening here is Ryan is trying to sort of pin down Trump's commitment to all of any number of conservative policies, and it's a hard thing to do when it's Donald Trump tends to say a lot of contradictory things, and so I think that the consensus view is someone like Paul Ryan is trying to sort of ensure that he will be reliably a conservative, trying to make the argument a sort of a political argument about, like, if you're going to be the nominee of the party, here's kind of what here's what Republicans are like.
It seems like Paul Ryan has had kind of a wild ride for not having been Speaker of the House for terribly long. He's facing a whole slate of unknowns with Donald Trump and now a challenger from back home for his seat in the House. What do we know about that challenger?
So Paul Ryan has a challenger from the right, a sort of a Tea Party or possibly a Trumpian businessman candidate named Paul Nehlen. Can we just say it doesn't seem to be a particularly serious challenger? There was the conservative website Right Wisconsin just today highlighted a poll that had Ryan with a lead of 78-14. The guy's Speaker of the House. He's extremely popular among conservatives. He's always been well regarded in his district. And as Speaker, he has more or less access to an unlimited amount of campaign money. So it's hard to see that it's exactly likely that he's going to go the way of Eric Cantor and lose his primary. But on the other hand, I'm sure it's a headache. I'm sure it's a pain. And you have there's certain people who are maybe not fans of Paul Ryan who have an interest in playing up the chances that that this guy might have to take him out.
And speaking of people who are not fans of Paul Ryan, Sarah Palin. Here's what she
there's one.
Here's what she had to say. Let's take a listen.
I think Paul Ryan is soon to be cantored as an Eric Cantor. His political career is over, but for a miracle, because he has so disrespected the will of the people. And as the leader of the GOP, the convention, certainly he is to remain neutral, and for him to already come out and say who he will not support was not a wise decision of his.
And there's Sarah Palin, not on board with Paul Ryan. How has he responded to that?
Sure. Sarah Palin noted for her steady, good political judgment, I guess. I mean, that's over the top, right? That's political career is over is kind of a funny thing to say. The thing to remember is Palin is also officially a Trump surrogate. Palin campaigned for Trump in Wisconsin. And so having her go on TV, go on CNN and sort of issue these attacks on Ryan, we don't know. Given what we know about Palin and about the Trump campaign, it's hard to say how coordinated this was, like how planned out. But we do know that that Trump was playing offense, and this is it's a signal. This is Trump has his surrogates, and if Ryan isn't going to go along, I assume that Trump has ways of making life at least a little bit unpleasant for Ryan.
And we're going to move on to a story that we've been tracking for quite a while now out of Wisconsin about Lincoln Hills. And there was news this week about a patient who got the incorrect medication not once but twice. What can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, so here's what we know. This happened twice in April of this year. This is a 15-year-old boy being held at Lincoln Hills. He was given the wrong psychotropic medication. He takes a pill for sleep and to prevent anxiety. Instead, he was given an antidepressant pill. And what is it's the twice part that is the especially disturbing, right? The facility called his mother, made a promise that it wouldn't happen again, and then it happened again. So this is part, you know, seen as part of these long-term problems with Lincoln Hills that have led to an investigation by the state that is now being conducted by the FBI into mismanagement, potentially criminal actions by guards and other employees. And so something like this is, I think everyone, you know, it is seen as certainly a mistake, but it's a question of is it a sign of mismanagement? One of the things in the report by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that came out is that medication is routinely distributed by guards at the facility.
Is that
not
unusual?
It seems like it's worth asking the question of whether that ought to be the province of a nurse or some sort of health professional. And it's certainly from the outside. I'm not an expert in this myself, but from the outside, it seems like that supports the claim that that staff at the facility are overstretched, and it's not. You wouldn't necessarily expect a guard to be conversant and familiar with medications. Go ahead.
No, you complete your thought. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, another thing that it raises is, so this is the other thing about it, is this is a facility for juveniles. There are, you know, how many of these, what is the role of mental illness, I guess, among the youth who are incarcerated there? That's another big question around this. The idea is that this should be a place for rehabilitation, for them to receive some programming that is needed. But I think that, you know, how many kids with mental illness are taking psychotropic drugs at this facility, and is it the best environment for them? That's the type of question that a lot of Lincoln Hills critics are raising, and at least Milwaukee County, which has taken steps toward removing kids from the facility.
It's our Wisconsin News Roundup, and we're talking with Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network in Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. And Robert, we're going to wrap up with a story about a couple of state lawmakers looking at holding a wolf summit in northern Wisconsin in the near future. What would be the purpose of the wolf summit?
So this is a charged, very controversial topic in the Northwoods. They're planning this. They want this summit to happen in September, and the goal. This is from Senator Tom Tiffany and Representative Adam Jarko. They're guys who do not agree with a federal court decision to return wolves to the endangered species list. So what they're wanting to call attention to is these incidents that are reported that have wolves killing or injuring livestock or pets. Tiffany noted that there have been 14 cases so far in 2016, according to the State Department of Natural Resources. And there's a lot of people in northern Wisconsin who see this as a safety issue. The DNR's argument is that there are things that they can do besides having a hunt or besides getting rid of the wolves. They can construct fencing. They're using sound or light to keep wolves away from more populated areas. But this is from the lawmakers' point of view and the advocates' point of view. What they want to do is point out that that wolves are, you know, more common than they have been in years, and that it's creating problems.
And we leave it there. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menser from the USA Today Network Wisconsin, helping us to recap the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a group of municipal leaders is making the case for more transportation funding in the state. We'll learn more about that coming up.
First, the Obama administration today issued guidelines to public schools to allow transgender students to use the bathrooms that correspond with their chosen gender identity.
The Departments of Justice and Education sent a joint letter offering guidelines to ensure that, quote, transgender students enjoy a supportive and non-discriminatory school environment.
The administration has been in a standoff with North Carolina's state government over its controversial bathroom bill called HB2, which prohibits people from using public bathrooms that don't correspond to their biological sex. Here's U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch speaking about this earlier.
Now, let me also speak directly to the transgender community itself. Some of you have lived freely for decades, and others of you are still wondering how you can possibly live the lives that you were born to live, to lead. But no matter how isolated, no matter how afraid, and no matter how alone you may feel today, know this, that the Department of Justice, and indeed the entire Obama administration, want you to know that we see you, we stand with you, and we will do everything we can to protect you going forward.
Megan Casella joins us now. She's a breaking news reporter for Reuters. She's been following this issue. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Megan, can you sum up what exactly changed, or what is the Obama administration advising schools to do in this announcement?
So the Obama administration is really giving a sign of solidarity with the transgender community, and they're saying that schools that receive federal funding, so public schools throughout the country, have to allow transgender students to choose the bathroom of their choice, the bathroom that they most closely think matches with their gender identity, as opposed to the gender that they were assigned at birth. And they're saying that to these schools, if they want to keep their federal funding, that this is the way that they have to treat transgender students without violating federal law.
Right. This announcement doesn't exactly bear the force of law, but it does put federal funding at risk for schools, maybe even whole states, I guess, if they don't follow these guidelines. Is that right?
Right. So the guidelines themselves, you know, the White House emphasized today that it's just a guidance. These are suggestions that the White House said, you know, schools had wanted and that they will welcome. But, you know, there's an implicit threat there that if schools decide not to abide by this, if states decide not to abide by this, then, you know, the administration says that they can threaten that federal funding because they're then violating federal law and they are discriminating against this group of students.
Yeah, what are the grounds for this? You mentioned a violation of federal law. What laws are they pointing to in the Obama administration behind this?
So they're pointing to Title IX. And, you know, it's a longstanding law, but this is the first time that the administration has spelled out that transgender students are included in that law. They're saying, you know, that this is a civil rights case, that this is another gay rights case, that, you know, these laws are already in place, but their interpretation now clearly says that transgender students are included in this and that they cannot be discriminated against under that law.
Well, this comes after some back and forth with the leadership in North Carolina over their bathroom bill, as it's been known. Can you give us some of the background on what's been going on between the federal government and North Carolina's state government?
Right. North Carolina first passed a law in March that, among other things, said that transgender students any transgender people in public buildings and in schools had to use the restroom that corresponded with their gender at birth. And just earlier this week, a week ago or so, the Justice Department sued North Carolina, saying that this was a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And North Carolina pushed back. And so, you know, the state and the Justice Department are now locked in this federal battle over, you know, over whether or not this law can stand. And the Department of Justice told North Carolina this week that they were just inventing a problem where one doesn't exist. So it's interesting to see how that will move forward. It's sort of a case study in that was the first state to pass a law such as this. And the administration's move today seems to be directly a response to what we saw in North Carolina and what other states have started considering.
Talking to Megan Casella from Reuters News Agency. Looking at this guideline announced by the White House today to departments, Justice and Education, offering guidelines for schools when it comes to bathroom policy and some other items, especially as it concerns transgender students there. You've been tracking the response from states, Megan. North Carolina, not the only state with a stake in this right now. What kind of things are you hearing from governors and other officials?
So governors, lieutenant governors, attorneys general, and particularly Republican-led states were quick to speak out against this. In Texas, they said, we don't mind if you want to threaten our federal funding. We will fill the gaps. Otherwise, you will not bully us into abiding by this sort of law. We saw that similar things in Alabama, in Arkansas. And so you know, these states are saying that this is a federal overreach, that there's no constitutional basis or no legal power behind the administration's argument that schools and states have to abide by these regulations. And so it's really, you know, everyone's gearing up for a fight, it seems, and it'll be interesting in whether the Justice Department will ultimately sue other states the way that we saw it did in North Carolina.
As you mentioned, the case by the Obama administration is that these bathroom laws saying students have to use the bathroom of their biological sex, their sex at birth, in effect discriminate against transgender students. That's not the argument coming from the states you're talking about or an effort to pass a similar law here in Wisconsin. What is the argument in favor of these bathroom bills from the people sponsoring them?
Those in support, primarily Republicans, are saying that it's a safety issue, particularly for young women and girls, are what you keep hearing brought up as a defense of the law. In that, they're saying a man who identifies as a woman and walks into a women's restroom then could hurt or, you know, somehow endanger women and girls who are in that restroom. And so that's sort of the argument in defense of it, saying that this is a safety thing. This is by no means discriminatory.
This has been a hot issue, not just in the state and federal government, but in the public at large. A lot of people weighing in on this. And you tried to, at Reuters, you tried to figure out what American people are thinking about this by conducting a poll. What kind of results did you get?
We found that Americans are pretty split on this. It was about 44% of them that we polled thought that people should be using the bathroom that corresponds with their biological gender, whereas about 39% that it should be the gender with which they identify. And given the margin of error and, you know, that we had a sample size that obviously wasn't everyone in the country, that it chalks it up to be about equal, that people really are divided and not sure yet how it's going to pan out.
Of course, we have a presidential race going on now. Have candidates been weighing in on this?
When the North Carolina law was passed, we saw Hillary Clinton say, absolutely, this needs to be fought back against. No one should be discriminated against. And then just today, we saw Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, had a little bit of a softer tone than many of his Republican counterparts. And he was saying that he didn't yet have a personal opinion about the law, but that at this point, it should be left up to the state. And he said, yes, of course, everyone has a right to be protected, but kept emphasizing that the transgender community was a very, very small portion of the population. The White House has said this is much more than just about transgender rights, but Trump emphasized that he thought it was, you know, a very small portion of the population and that at this point it should simply be a state's issue.
And people in states backing these laws have said, okay, the White House is making a mistake here. We're hoping for Congress and the courts to weigh in. So what are the next steps in the federal legislature, if any? I don't know if any action is going on there and in the courts.
At this point, it'll be interesting to see how things do progress. You know, what the White House put out today was simply guidance and doesn't have legal implications. But if states move forward with concrete laws and pieces of legislation the way that North Carolina did, we might see the Justice Department move forward with more lawsuits against other states trying to fight back and saying that you can't discriminate this way. So at this point, it's going to be, you know, which states fall into line and decide to abide by this guidance and which ones really vehemently fight back. So it'll be interesting to see how that does progress.
I mentioned that there was an effort in the Wisconsin legislature in the previous session to pass a bill people viewed as similar to what was in North Carolina that didn't end up coming to a vote. We had the sponsor of that legislation on the show saying he would bring that back in the next session. As this is all going on the national level, people watching North Carolina, do you see other states maybe passing similar laws of their own?
Some states are. Some have talked about it, and some have already done it. It was in Mississippi where they have passed similar legislation that was viewed as discriminatory by gay and civil rights groups, gay rights, civil rights groups. And other ones, I believe, including Missouri, have considered it, and it hasn't yet made it out of committee, or it's currently stalled or was shot down. That was Tennessee and Missouri that considered similar measures. So it is something that, you know, I think the White House's move today was sort of a way of them getting out before more states may, you know, follow suit and say, listen, this is our position on this, and any further action you take to violate these laws might, you know, bring a counterforce, counterargument.
We've talked some about state responses, state leadership responses to this advisory, this guideline from the White House. How about those civil rights groups you mentioned and groups that advocate for LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans? Have they been responding to this announcement today from the Department of Justice and the Department of Education?
Absolutely. They've been celebrating it. You know, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU for one, was one that came out and said the guidance would help make students feel free to bring their whole selves to school, that they could really be themselves. We saw similar responses from the Human Rights Campaign, from most of the big names that you hear, but everyone thought this was a great show of support from the administration and a big step forward for them.
And Megan, briefly, as we wrap up, it sounds like the next step is going to be in courtrooms around the country.
It will depend on what states do, if they decide to totally defy the administration and enact further laws, then you're probably going to see some counterseats by the Justice Department.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Megan Casella. She's a breaking news reporter at Reuters News Agency.
Coming up, Wisconsin's transportation network is aging and becoming more congested, and state municipal leaders are calling for more investment from the state legislature. We'll learn more about that after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. By the way, thanks to everyone who pledged during our brief three-day spring membership drive. 1,600 people made contributions to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks. Stick around. There's more to come on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7, Ken Rudin is back for this week's edition of The Political Junkie. Tonight, Ken and his guests try to figure out why Donald Trump exceeded expectations, why Bernie Sanders is performing well in the most recent primaries as well. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, transportation issues are a hot topic here in Wisconsin with a long-running debate over how to pay for roads. Local governments are getting into the debate, saying they're being left in the lurch many times without enough money to maintain local roads or update public transit systems and bike lanes. The League of Wisconsin Municipalities is taking up the issue and calling for more money to be used to fund transportation here in the state.
Joining us now to talk about transportation funding in Wisconsin is Jerry DeShane. He's the executive director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks, Veronica. Thank you for having me on.
So why choose this particular moment to press for more funding for transportation issues?
Well, actually, I took the idea from the lieutenant governor. I was at a rural development conference a couple of weeks ago, and the question of roads came up, and Lieutenant Governor Clayfish said, we need to have a family conversation about this. The bottom line is that road support to local governments has dropped in the last 10 years, 17% adjusted for inflation. And it's beginning to wear. Road replacement budgets are getting stretched longer and longer. And all aspects of the transportation network in Wisconsin are, quite frankly, on the verge of trouble.
Jerry, when we think of transportation funding in the state, a lot of times we think highway funding. Are we overlooking what's happening at the local level?
Well, I can guarantee you that my mayors and village presidents aren't overlooking it. Ironically, we just had a meeting in Milwaukee yesterday of about 36 mayors and city managers and village presidents, and this is one of their top priorities for discussions with legislators leading up to the election. This is a major issue for local governments.
Now, you said just a moment ago that transportation across the state is on the verge of being in trouble. What kind of trouble do you see coming?
Well, everything from more people tripping on sidewalks to the SS Badger not being able to get out of the harbor, which is what happened yesterday, by the way. All aspects of transportation. Well, let me back up just a little bit. It's no secret that our gas tax, which is the primary source of funding transportation, hasn't really gone up in decades. And the cost of concrete, the cost of blacktop, the cost of sidewalks, all of these things have continued to rise. And it's pretty simple math. That doesn't add up. I think we've done a good job belt tightening and getting more efficient, but we're to the point now where we can't do that.
Jerry, I think there's been a lot of agreement from state lawmakers and others. People want more money for roads. The sticking point is how to pay for it. Nobody agrees on increasing the gas tax, user fees, that sort of thing. Bonding, there's been some bonding to pay for roads in the state. That's been even controversial. As you lobby legislators, as you try to get focus on this issue, do you have ideas of where the money should come from?
Well, the league hasn't taken a specific position on which form of user fee should be tapped, but whether it's in addition to the gas tax or in addition to the registration fee or some other creative combination of those, we would support any mix, to be perfectly honest with you. I think our perspective is it's time to fix it. Let's get it done. Let's not get caught up about, you know, this mode is a little bit better than that mode. It's just time to move on.
So what does that mean, moving on? I mean, this has been a sticky wicket in the state for a long time, and that's because it's not an easy problem to solve. So how do we move on and fund roads?
Well, you do it by doing what we're doing right now. We start talking about it. As Lieutenant Governor said, we need to have a family conversation about this. There are 600 cities and villages in Wisconsin, and the league is asking every one of them to take this issue up with their legislators, to take them on a pothole tour, you know, to show them the condition of their sidewalks and their ports. I think there is support for more revenue. I should go back when the Lieutenant Governor was having that family conversation. It was with a room full of about 200 people. It was a rural development summit. And of all of the different options, she'd ask for a show of hands, and gas tax probably got the most hand raises. Registration fee was right up there. But the one option that only got about three or four people in favor was the do-nothing option. So I think conservatives and liberals and lefties and righties in Wisconsin all drive on roads, and we all use buses, and we all know that you got to pay for that.
Talking to Jerry DeShane with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, his organization is joining in on a Just Fix It campaign calling for more state investment in transportation and funding for local transportation. And as he said, that means roads and streets, and it means sidewalks and harbors and mass transit, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is transportation like in your local area? Lots of potholes? Do you have the public transit options you wish you had? Could the roads be better? How should we pay for that in Wisconsin? If you're involved in local government, love to hear from you. Are you feeling like you are in a bind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jerry, can you talk some more about that bind you're hearing from local officials? Are their hands tied when it comes to trying to pay for local improvements?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, in local governments, it's a double whammy. Not only has that state support been eroded over the years, local governments' property taxes are limited by state law. They couldn't spend more money on it if they want to. I was talking to a village president up in Marinette County, and their road repair budget, what he told me was, we have just enough to blacktop the road over a water main break in the winter, and that's about all we can do.
As we talk about this problem and get a handle about how it's more than just kind of a nuisance, let's look at the big picture. How does this affect, say, the state's economy?
That absolutely affects the state's economy. Transportation, ironically, was a part of that mayor's summit that we had yesterday. And there are companies that pick up and deliver produce and milk products in the southwest part of the state that have had to alter their truck routes. They've had to use different grain elevators because the roads to get you from point A to point B can no longer support the weight of the trucks that are traveling up. You hear these sorts of reports, whether it's forestry or moving shipping out of the Milwaukee Harbor. You hear these reports all over the state.
Let's bring in a caller now. We've got Paula on the line in Appleton. Paula, hi.
Hi. I joined late, so maybe this was discussed. Isn't part of the funding debate the problem that there really was quite a bit of transportation funding, but that fund was rated for other things through the years?
Well, Paula raises a terrific question, and the voters actually resolved that issue a couple of years ago. Going back, about 10 years ago, the state had a budget shortfall, and they took transportation money out to pay for some other state funding needs. That money is no longer being taken out. And in order to prevent that from happening again, 2 years ago, the voters in Wisconsin amended the Constitution to say that you cannot take transportation funds out of the transportation budget. It is now a segregated budget. Anything that goes into it stays in it.
Paula, thanks for that call. Jerry, part of the bind, as I understand it, is that we have the gas tax staying at the same percentage level, but we have more fuel-efficient vehicles, so using a little less gas, and that's been part of why there's less money going into that transportation fund. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, we about 20 years ago, we took out what was called indexing of the gas tax. It doesn't automatically go up with inflation anymore. But along the same lines, fuel efficiency for cars and for trucks, for that matter, continued to get better. So that's good news, but the reality is, in real dollar terms, you're paying less for the use of those streets than you were 20 years ago.
And let's go back to our callers now. We've got Daniel on the line in Toma. Daniel, hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Look, I was from Missouri, I was raised here, and my whole life, the roads have never been this bad. I drive newspapers every day, so I know all the roads in our town. Toma, Wisconsin has the worst roads. And I tell people it's the worst roads, and I don't understand. I asked the city guy, he said their budget's only $200,000 a year for the whole year. That's ridiculous. We buy more than $200,000 worth of tax money just in that city alone.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Daniel. And Daniel, Jerry talking about the roads in Toma, saying that he's familiar with them and they're not in great shape. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, I know the mayor of Toma, and I certainly don't want to say they've got the worst roads in the state. But, I mean, unfortunately, that is typical. As local budgets get stretched, you plan to replace roads every so many years. And in some cases, that number is 200 years we'll replace the roads. To be blunt, with $200,000, Toma will never replace all its streets. And streets don't last forever.
And we're talking right now with Jerry DeShane, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He's joining us to talk about transportation issues facing the state and what funding he'd like to see to help fix that problem.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the state dedicate more funding to transportation or allow local governments to increase property taxes to meet transportation needs? Streets and roads, buses and bikes, harbors too. Where should the money come from, and what's the story where you are? How are the roads, the sidewalks, the bike paths, the buses, if any? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about roads and transportation funding in Wisconsin. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, the state ranks third in the nation for having the worst road conditions.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should the state spend more on roads and streets and sidewalks, bike paths, buses? Where should the money come from, and how are things in your area? How are the potholes? How are the buses? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're continuing our conversation with Jerry DeShane. He's the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and recently wrote a piece calling on the state to invest more in our transit network. And back to our phones we go. We're going to take a call next from Mike in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
You're wondering why the heck you're getting a call from Illinois. I went to school in Milwaukee, and, Wisconsin's a beautiful state, and certain there's a good part of revenue that is from tourism, and, perhaps near major city hubs. I know you're talking about the outlying areas, rural areas. Perhaps put a toll up, or a tourism toll, or in the grocery stores or whatever. I mean, goods and services have to be delivered there by trucks. So you could maybe, no one likes taxes. And there's, you can't ignore the problem, and I'm not suggesting a runaway toll like we have here in Illinois.
But some manner of toll, Mike says. And you know, you're not the first person to say this, Mike. It has come up before, even from inside the state of Wisconsin. What about that, Jerry? Should we consider some sort of a toll?
Well, I think it's one of the ideas that needs to be considered in the future. But the reality is that is against federal law. We can't do that right now. Illinois had the right to do tolling when the interstate system was built, and all of the states that had it could keep it, but those that did not could not, and Wisconsin fell on the other side of that. But I think a good point that Mike makes is let's not think just one source here. Let's not think just gas tax. There's got to be more creative ways of doing this. And the reality is, yeah, first of all, he is right. Let's not break the bank, but a mix of things, a little bit of registration fee, a little bit of gas tax. You know, there are a number of other sources, and maybe we need to be creative and think of some that haven't even been thought of yet.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. We'll go next to Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a problem that you know, every state faces, and I've lived in several. I've lived in New York, Florida, and now here. Part of the problem is that, you know, you're giving the choice of higher taxes or higher property taxes, and that's putting it all on most of the population. What it's not touching are the businesses, the main mega corporations that use the roads as well through trucking. As an example, GE made billions of dollars last year in profit and was not taxed $1. Because of whatever loopholes and whatever programs they were doing for green energy or however it's supposed to work out for them, they paid no tax. And not everybody is paying their fair share of tax into the system.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So, Jerry, is there some way to have a corporate tax that would be targeted toward the roads that presumably corporations are using, as he's saying?
Well, I guess we would generally favor something that looks as close to a user fee as you can get. In other words, the trucks, whether they're GE's trucks or Walmart's trucks or whose trucks they are, the trucks that use the roads should pay their proportionate share, just as the cars that use the roads should pay their proportionate share. I think people would be most supportive of spreading the burden out and spreading it out fairly, but we would favor staying as close to some sort of user fee as you can.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. And Jerry, thanks so much for joining us today.
I enjoyed the conversation very much, and I hope it continues.
We've been talking to Jerry DeShane. He's the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He joined us to talk about a call for increased investment in Wisconsin's roads and transportation infrastructure. And you can still weigh in on that issue. And we've got a link to a piece Jerry wrote. You can find that all on the Central Time Facebook page. And, of course, you can always share your thoughts on Twitter, at Central Time WPR.
The election season begins in earnest this weekend as the Republican Party of Wisconsin holds its annual convention in Green Bay. Democrats will meet in Green Bay 3 weeks later for their convention. Observers say it's a sign of northeastern Wisconsin's potential influence on several important races. Patty Murray reports.
Why would both parties hold their conventions in Green Bay?
It's hardly a coincidence. This area tends to be a swing area. It's extremely important.
UW Oshkosh political scientist Jim Simmons says southwestern Wisconsin trends Democratic, while the southeastern part of the state is more reliably conservative. Meanwhile, Green Bay, the Fox Valley, and points in between are different.
Larger numbers of independents, larger numbers of swing voters. When you look at the turnout in a presidential election year versus a midterm election year, you have an increasing number of voters who claim to be independent or moderate.
Simmons says partisan voters rarely split the ticket, while independents are more willing. Even the landscape and the people who live there are a mixed bag, according to Marion Krumberger, chair of the Brown County Republicans.
We have city, we have farms, we have a cross-section of people and representation of all of Wisconsin voters.
The region also has an open congressional seat. Incumbent Republican Reed Ribble isn't running. Pat Garrett is a spokesman for the Republican Party of Wisconsin.
Well, so Green Bay has always been an important battleground, and we see that especially now. You know, Hillary Clinton continues to be viewed unfavorably and untrustworthy by voters in northeastern Wisconsin. There's a congressional race in the Wisconsin 8th congressional district. We have three great candidates running.
Two Democrats have also announced for the 8th Congressional District, which is far and away the most competitive district in Wisconsin. It seems the only thing the two parties agree on is that the region swings. Martha Lanning heads the state Democratic Party. The party wants to retake the state Senate, and she sees one of its best chances in a district that covers parts of Winnebago and Fond du Lac counties.
I think the 18th Senate District is a great example. You know, we have a primary there, but we have two great candidates running in that district, and we believe that that's a strong pickup opportunity for us.
If ever there was a swing district, the 18th is it. Republicans have won the seat by less than one percentage point in each of the last two general elections. Democrats won it in the 2011 recall by just over 2%. Democrats would have to win at least three districts to get a Senate majority. Another thing about northeastern Wisconsin, it's a sizable media market. Rich Langan is with the Brown County Democrats. He says viewers and commercial radio listeners will be bombarded with ads and news coverage.
The hardest thing for a candidate to do is get his or her words or face out into the public. And the biggest bang for your buck is the big media marketplaces, and Green Bay is the second largest in the state, so I think they would be foolish not to come here.
Of course, the presidential candidates will be a big draw both at rallies and the polls. UWO political scientist Jim Simmons.
So the one last wild card in all this is Donald Trump.
It's an understatement to say that Trump has had a polarizing effect on voters this election cycle. The question is how he'll play to the swing voters of northeastern Wisconsin. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.